Today's Teisho will be on case 34 in the Book of Serenity. Case 34 is entitled Feng Shui Single Atom. Introduction. Barehanded, empty-fisted, 1,000 changes, 10,000 transformations. Though this is making something out of nothing, what can you do? You employ the provisional to symbolize the real. But tell me, is there a fundamental basis or not? Feng Shui said, if you set up a single atom, the nation flourishes. If you don't set up a single atom, the nation perishes. Zhuido held up his staff and said, are there any mendicants who will die the same and live the same? Verse, as a graybeard rising from a hunt by the Wei River, how does that compare to those who starved in purity on Mount Shuyang? It just lies in a single atom, distinguishing changing conditions, fame and accomplishment. Both are hard to efface. So thank you all for practicing so wholeheartedly. Everybody's coming into the Dokusan room and with deep engagement, deep sitting. It's wonderful, really thrilling. So this koan is connected to the previous koan. Yesterday I was talking about how the monkey mind is not such a bad thing. I was basically saying that we misunderstand the problem. You know, we misunderstand the problem when we think that our job on the cushion is to control our minds. Right? So, you know, that mentality of controlling something always gets us into trouble. Right? It gets us into trouble. Many people think that they have to control their animal pets, right? If you have a dog, you know, my father, we had a dog when I was growing up. And my father, trained the dog to come by having a long string that he attached to the puppy's collar. And then my father would say to the dog, whose name was Sergeant, the puppy, he'd say, "Come, come," and the poor puppy would be so scared of my father raising his voice like that. And then my father would pull the dog across the floor on the rope. And as an adult, I would have just been horrified, right, you know. But I didn't have the knowledge base to understand what was wrong with this picture. But I felt so sorry for my little puppy being dragged across the floor by my father while my father barked at him orders in a language that poor little puppy didn't understand. So, my father was big on controlling things, right? And I feel that robbed him of a lot of opportunities to experience life richly. You know, I think my father was always trying to control himself and distrusted himself very much. And so he sort of brought that mentality to all of his relationships, including with his little puppy, and including with his children and his wife and so on. You know, my father grew up in a difficult time. He grew up during the Depression in Newark, New Jersey. And he grew up like on the streets, you know, sort of like tough. You know, he had to not get beaten up at school, that kind of thing. So my father, my aunt, my father's older sister, Joan, was like a really good student. She was like the ideal child. And my grandparents, would just lavish their affection on Joan because she would get straight A's in school, right? And my father was always acting up. You know, he was always getting into trouble. And he was always disappointing my grandparents, right? So at some point, he was in the World War II. He came back and he tried to get himself together. You know, he went to college and he got a degree, and went to work for the Department of Defense after World War II, but my father was always like, keeping the lid on himself. I think he was afraid he was going to turn into that wild teenager again, down the shore, or in the city, getting into all kinds of trouble and sleeping around. And my grandparents were afraid he was going to turn into a gangster, right? Which was probably a possibility, So my father was big on control, and he was, my father got to know the dog, the dog's name was Sergeant, they developed a deep bond. My father actually loved that dog, right? He really was changed by his relationship with the dog. He stopped trying to control the dog, and he began to have a relationship with the dog, right? I remember, I was too young to appreciate what was happening. I didn't realize, my father is being transformed by his relationship with this little, with his collie. Actually, it was a collie. And my father had never had any pets growing up in a rather urban setting in an apartment, right? My father didn't really know how to interact with pets, with the animals. But he had, it's in retrospect, I can see that he had this deep, loving relationship with Sergeant. My father, at one point, my father was a chain smoker, and the doctor told him, his name was Larry. He said, "Larry, you've got to get you've got to do something. You have to quit smoking and get some exercise." So my father decided to take up running, right? Sarge would go for a run, right? He didn't look forward to the run. My father really didn't like, physical exercise, But he loved the going out with Sarge on a walk run in the morning, right? And sometimes he would drive his car, and Sarge would run after the car for a certain distance, and my father would come back and say, "You won't believe it, he did 30 miles an hour today, So he was it was like a deep, loving relationship. And when Sarge died, my father was inconsolable for a while, right? He just loved that dog so much. So when he no longer was trying to control the situation, he could be intelligent and have an emotionally intelligent relationship. He wasn't always able to do this with people. So often people are able to do this with animals, but not always so well with people, right? So, my father, I would say, was not a great father. You know, he was too, I think he carried a lot of insecurities that prevented him from being open with his children. And I think he was so worried that we were going to go off the rails that he didn't ever get to know us, right? So you know, there's lots of stories about that I could tell you about how he wasn't really aware of my siblings, my brother and my sister, who they were or what they were, how they were trying to signal to him they wanted his appreciation, they wanted his attention and respect, and he didn't give it. And it's not like he didn't care, it's that he was unable to get past this desire to control things, right? So my brother was a very, he was the looker in the family. He was very handsome, he had a very broad shoulders and a narrow waist. And I was the nerd because I wasn't an athlete. My brother was a really good athlete, you know, and my father was never really approving of my brother's being an athlete. You know, he wanted my brother to be a nerd, you know, and you know, my brother could just, I myself ran cross country, but I never got any, you know, I was always just, you know, I was in the competition, but my brother was really, he could really run. He was a real sprinter and he was very fast, you know, and when I look back on it, I realize my father was just afraid. You know, he was always coming to human relationships afraid that things were going to go wrong. And, you know, he could eat, and especially my brother reminded my father of himself. You know, so my father would look at my brother and he would see his younger self, basically getting into trouble and maybe turning into a gangster or something. And my brother, experimented with marijuana and actually got arrested for possession in Richmond. He was down there visiting some friends, and my father was, you know, sure then that my brother was on the way to the penitentiary, you know, because his parents were afraid he was on the way to becoming Meyer Lansky or something. This is relationships based on control are not necessarily the best relationships, right? Because we can, if we're not trying to control the situation, we can, have this emotional, intelligent relationship with what's happening. So, yesterday I said that in Buddhist, early Buddhist teaching, there's this idea of the mind as a monkey. The mind's a monkey. And it's a wild animal that we have to tame, just like my father and the dog, right? And I was kind of trying to make the case that don't do that to that poor monkey, right? You know, develop a loving and a emotionally intelligent relationship with the monkey, your mind, right? And the attempt, I think that there are many people in the Zen world also misunderstand what Zen practice is all about. They really do think that this is about controlling your mind. And we recite those lines every day. You know, I will control my mind and be detached from my physical self. And I urge you not to do that, you know, actually, you know. I think it's better to have a relationship with what's happening. See, a relationship. This koan is, you know, basically talking about an event. This has a lot of references from Chinese history, basically. But the story is basically connected to the rise of the Duke of Zhou in China, and basically there was this political figure who was very helpful at a time of crisis, and he eventually led a reform movement that caused the Middle Kingdom to prosper. And meanwhile, there were these two brothers who were heirs to the throne, and they didn't exercise their responsibility. They were basically detached or indifferent to things around them, and they fell from power. And then they were, according to legend, they were so bitter that they, when there was a new government, they refused to eat any food produced under the rule of the new government. And they lived on this mountain and just tried to live on plants they foraged, and they starved to death. That's the story. So basically, this is about, this is a reference to, this one political figure who engaged with his time, engaged with the circumstances in a creative and helpful spirit, and saved the Middle Kingdom. And there were these other two spoiled brats, basically, who were indifferent to what was happening and didn't save the improve the situation when things were going downhill, and then ended up bitter and cursing their fate and so on. So Feng Shui said, if you set up a single atom, the nation flourishes. If you don't set up a single atom, the nation perishes. See, so that's sort of like, we need to, the issue is really when we say, if you're sitting on the cushion, and you have a thought, you're sitting on the cushion and you're trying to be peaceful and you're trying to be sweet. And then you think about, because Buddhists are peaceful and gentle and so on. And then you have this memory maybe of when I lived in Baltimore, I used to go to school and I had to be careful not to get beaten up by some of the tougher kids. And every once in a while, I will have fantasies of violent revenge. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, I have to confess, I have these. I have a secret enjoyment of moments where the underdog in a movie, right? Every martial arts movie you've ever seen, or our hero is getting beaten to the ground, right? And then for some reason he suddenly gets his act together, he gets up and he absolutely, knocks his opponent through the wall, right? It's just so satisfying, right? It's like, oh, thank God. Yeah, boy, was that ever deserved, right? The little kid in me who did indeed sometimes get beaten up, I take such pleasure. It's so wonderful to think that thought, right? So maybe I'm sitting on the cushion and something comes up from my past, maybe being beaten up. Actually, in my high school, a couple kids jumped me when I was in the 11th grade. They jumped me in the bathroom and they tried to shove my face in the toilet. And I'm proud, I actually am very proud of the fact they were unable to do it. I held off like three guys, you know. So, you know, but when I think of those guys trying to shove my face in the toilet, you know, I feel burning rage, right? And there's a part of me, the fantasy is, you know, that I've studied martial arts and I go back and, you know, I run into them somewhere and I just throw them through the wall, right? You know, when you have a thought like that and you say, oh my God, you know, I'm a Zen teacher, I'm not supposed to have thoughts like that. You know, where can I hide this thought, right? Where can I push this out of the way, right? I think that's such a mistake. I think that closes down any possibility you're creating a barrier, right? You're creating a barrier. You're closing down on, this is a wonderful opportunity to pursue awakening. And, you know, you're letting your expectation get in the way, or it could be shame, or, you know, the Dalai Lama often teaches about how bad anger is, but I worry that when he does that, because I don't think people should be angry or act out of anger, but when we experience anger, how are we supposed to deal with it? I myself have envy. I am envious of people sometimes. And I don't always allow myself to see it, but every once in a while it'll peek out and I'll realize I'm envious, you know. And, you know, I could say, uh-oh, you know, a Buddhist doesn't feel envy, but actually, you know, the presence of envy is this opportunity, right? It's this opportunity to see your envy, to see your fear, to see your anger. As soon as you try to control them, you're like my father with a little puppy, right? You're dragging it across the ground. But you know, my father didn't know how to raise a dog when he was raising that little dog. He began to have some clue about how to raise a dog, you know, when he had a relationship with Sergeant, when Sergeant was older. And I'm sure, or at least I hope, that my father, if he had had another dog, wouldn't have done the same thing all over again. You know, people take some many lifetimes to learn, but hopefully he wouldn't have done the same thing. You know, we have a tendency, especially with difficult emotions or difficult experiences, you know, because they're so disruptive and uncontrollable, we fear that if we get close to them, they'll become overwhelming. Right? Like anxiety. It's like, I have had an anxiety disorder, partly because of my family. But when I was just starting out in the academic world, I remember a couple times I started to give a paper and I just had an anxiety attack, you know? And I toughed it out, I pushed through. But it was murder. You know, if you've ever had an anxiety attack, it's just like you feel like you're just going to burst into tears in front of, you know, 50 people. And, you know, my voice became halting and it was just like running through quicksand trying to read my paper. And After that, I had already done Zen for many years. I made a point of always meditating before I gave my paper, and it helped enormously. Really, it was just like night and day, right? I absolutely would meditate. I would, you know, if I'm at a conference, I would stay in the hotel until I was, you know, had to get to my, I'd leave enough time to get to the conference room, and I would meditate, and then I would go in and get, it was so much better. But, you know, when you have these emotions and they grip you, we fear, you know, you fear that your anxiety is just going to turn, it's like a little trickle, but it's going to turn into an ocean. And so we want to run away, but running away, trying to control the situation, I think, is the wrong response. There's a wonderful story. There was a Dutch writer, he was a Zen Buddhist. His name was, I'm going to mispronounce his name, but it was Jan Willem van de Wettering. And he wrote these wonderful detective novels that are all about Zen under the surface, right? They're about these detectives in Amsterdam, but there's a subtext which is all about Buddhism. And the police commissioner is like a Roshi. If you know Zen, you can realize he's the Roshi figure. But in this book, one of the stories that Van de Wettering wrote is about a Zen priest, a Japanese Zen priest, and the detective is investigating a murder of this very wealthy woman. And he realizes that the murderer was this very famous Zen master in Japan. And he finally goes to see the Zen master and arrest him. And the Zen master says very calmly, I was wondering when you were coming, you know. He said, let me tell you what happened. You know, I have this national reputation. I'm a very famous Zen priest. This woman was, we got a little too close, and we fell in love, and we had an illicit affair. And then, you know, we had a falling out, and she threatened to make it public, and I killed her. And he said, I know that what I did was wrong, and I know that I'm going to be reborn in a hell realm, or many hell realms, until I've expiated this crime, this terrible crime. And he confesses, and they send him to prison. And the narrator, the detective, goes to see him in prison. He's very calm. He's doing his zazen. And the guy says, you're so calm. He doesn't know if the priest has no remorse or... And the priest says, I have done something that's unthinkably terrible. And I deserve to many rebirths in hell for what I've done. And he said, every time I sit down on the cushion, I see that woman's face and I see my crime. And it's like the fires of hell already. He said, but what can I do? If you go to hell, if you find yourself in hell, what are you supposed to do? You have to sit down on the cushion and work your way out of hell. If you make a terrible mistake, you just have to sit down on the cushion and start working your way out of your confusion. There's no other way. If I'm making any sense, this might seem a little bit disorganized, but when we feel stress or panic, we say, oh, I shouldn't be here. I should be somewhere else. But you're there. You have to work with that. You could say, but the Dalai Lama doesn't have panic attacks. But where you are right now, you're in the flames of panic. You're in depression. You have to be where you have to. The way out is where you are right now. And the door is the obstacle you're facing now. If that makes sense. So, the priest did a terrible thing and he deserves to be reborn in many hell realms. But if you're in a hell realm, what do? You roll up your sleeves and you start confronting your obstacles and working through your barriers, right? That's all we can do. The priest could have said, oh my God, I've done a terrible thing, and he could have killed himself. But then, in traditional Buddhist thought, he'd wake up in a hell realm again, and he'd say, oh, I'm in an even lower hell realm, because not only did I commit murder, but I killed myself. And he could keep killing himself and dropping down into hell deeper and deeper. But at some point he realizes the only way out of this is for me to work through my barriers, is to work through my obstacles. So you know, he has a big one. He killed somebody. That's the worst thing you can do. So but he has the right spirit in spite of making a very human but terrible mistake. And that is to sit down on the cushion and in one breath at a time, work our way out of hell. See? So you know, when we have these thoughts, you know, trying to control them is not the way. You know, what we need to do is to be with our anxiety, be with our fear, be with, and you know, these negative, so-called negative emotions are our teachers, right? They're the source of our wisdom. You know, this is there's no other teachers but our obstacles in this world, right? So, you know, when I stopped trying to not be anxious when I gave talks, when I was okay with anxiety, you know, gradually my anxiety just went away. You know, when I don't give that many talks now, but there was definitely a time in my life when I gave a lot of talks and people probably wished I had an anxiety disorder so I would shut up. But you know, embracing my anxiety, yes, you know, what if I have an anxiety attack? That's just how it goes. So, you know, actually, it may be a physiological thing. It may have nothing. It may be caused by the way you respirate, believe it or not, some people think. So you just say, okay, this is anxiety. This is what I have to work with. And you keep reading, and you stop. We're afraid that if I acknowledge my anxiety, it will wash over me like an ocean, and I will be swept away. But if you acknowledge your anxiety, you know, it goes away. It's like it transforms into something else. Really, it transforms into something else. It's like. Anxiety, it's very interesting, you know, if you give a talk and you're just cool and calm and you give the talk, often it's not a very good talk. You know, sometimes having that edge, right, there's a kind of an edge, like you're dancing on the edge of fear, you know, gives your talk this power and this, you know, that you're being calm doesn't always impart, you know. So, you know, it's definitely the case that these things that confront us, these so-called obstacles, are this wonderful opportunity to wake up if we don't try to control them and we allow ourselves to be present with them, in fact, to become one with. See, become one with your anxiety. Become one with your fear. You know, you know, our fear only has power over us so long as we're trying to conquer it. See, I would say. Our fear only has power over us as long as we're trying to be fearless. Right? You know, when you're afraid and you simply are present with, it's like you focus on your fear, if you're feeling fear, you focus on your fear just like on a koan. And you just make fear your whole attention. You know, you often find that it simply dissolves, or it transforms into energy, this powerful energy. You know, so the problem is that when we're experiencing something, you know, we want to be somewhere else. That seems to be what really gets us into trouble, right? You know, when whatever is happening is really happening. And, you know, it can be a terrible thing. It can be a terrible thing. But it's all we have to work with right now. And whatever is happening is actually helping us wake up. If we can get out of our own way, you know, if it, and we get in our own way by saying, this is not what should be happening, this should be happening, right? So, you know, I guess my father wanted to say to his dog, Sergeant, come. And the dog would have gotten up and, in a sort of military style, walked over to my father. But my father, actually, Sarge would never come. When he got to be a mature dog, you say, Sarge, come. And he'd just walk away. It was like, no way. No, you don't have this rope anymore. It was endearing, right? So he was so much more interesting a person. My dog was so much more interesting a person than my father's plans for him could accommodate. My dog had so much more wisdom than my father, really, on this occasion. And, you know, our so-called obstacles can become, you know, these incredible, they're the teachers, right? So when we're feeling anxious or we're feeling, I have moments too where, you know, I come home from my class and I think, oh my God, this class is just falling apart. You know, it's falling apart. They're not getting it. And, you know, as long as you try to hold that feeling at bay, you know, or you say, I'm not supposed to be feeling this. I've been doing Zen practice for 50 years. There it is. There it is. What are you going to do about it? And pushing it away, you have to be present with your anxiety. I'm feeling anxious about this. And then that turns into a deeper sympathy for your students, sympathy for yourself. You suddenly realize, oh, yeah, I've worked so hard, you know. I'm trying to be a really good teacher, you know. And my students, I see now they're struggling, but here's what I probably need to do instead that will get through to them. So, you know, denial or wanting to be somewhere else is always like very bad strategy. It's closing the door on the messenger that's come to help us, right? The messenger. You know, anxiety actually is very good. You know, if we didn't have anxiety, things would, you know, we'd be dead. We'd have probably been dead long ago. You know, I can think of so many crazy things I did as a kid where I was actually arrested by anxiety. You know, and it was, thank God, I would have killed myself. So basically, this koan is really talking about how... Feng Shui's single atom. You know, if you embrace what is happening, and nobody wants to embrace fear, but if you focus on fear single-mindedly, right? My experience is that it will transform into something else. Insight. And, you know, if you embrace your anxiety, it will transform into something else, insight, right? Feng Shui said, if you set up a single atom, and he means, and you push it away, if you set up a single atom and you become one with it, the nation flourishes. If you don't set up a single atom, the nation perishes. Zhui Do held up his staff and said, are there any mendicants who will die the same and live the same? Right? So this is the way. Is there anybody who understands that this is the way? In the Pali Suttas, there's a story that's so powerful. You know, there was a person, I may have talked about him before, named Angulimala. And Angulimala was very much mistreated as a child and done many injustices. And as a result, he became a robber, you know, like a highway robber. And he would, you know, waylay caravans, and then he would kill everybody on the caravan and take their wealth. And he would cut their fingers off, and he made a wreath around his neck of fingers. That's his name, means wreath of fingers. You know, and he one day saw this person on the road, and he was going to kill him. And it was the Buddha. And when he met the Buddha, they had an exchange, and Anguimala realized that his all of his murderous behavior came from this place of utter hopelessness, right, about himself, and the belief that he would never be free from his suffering. And he actually shaved his head and became a monk. And according to the suttas, he achieved Daikensho. You know, many people in the Sangha grumbled, like, why didn't he have to go to hell for 20 lifetimes? Look at all the people he killed. But, you know, basically this is the power of becoming one with our lives, with what's happening now. You know, it doesn't matter, you know, please don't kill anybody. But when we become one with whatever has happened, with whatever this moment might bring, there's a door to our real liberation. And, you know, all of us are on that path now, and all of us have these so-called obstacles that are waiting to help us wake up. Let's continue to encounter them.